All right, Zayd Dahaj, thank you so much for joining us on the Fox Den. It's good to have you.
Of course, it's a pleasure to be on. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, just going over your Twitter timeline and all of the productivity tips that are evidence-based, it's very exciting. I know we're going to get into some great stuff. So before too much content, let's get into who you are, like what inspired you to do this. You're really into soccer. So, and what's your background education-wise?
Yeah, so I mainly surround my identity around three fundamental things. So at least for right now, I'm a writer, I'm a philosopher, which just means a lover of wisdom, right, and I'm an athlete, more specifically soccer.
Right.
So those three things are very important to me. In terms of education, I went to a private school in Southern California, private middle school. It was actually very religiously motivated. It was an Islamic middle school, which was good experience. And then obviously high school, but then after high school, I just stopped because I got a bad taste in my mouth with the overall education system. And then that's when I really started my path to educating myself and taking education into my own hands.
Awesome. You know, there's something fascinating about being self-taught. Throughout America's early history, people would go to one-room schoolhouses where they were in there and integrated with a bunch of kids from different ages. And if people wanted to be more self-taught, I mean, if they wanted to learn more, they would have to pick up their education and really read a lot and do things to kind of enhance it themselves. There's no drive like being inspired yourself to get things done. It's very interesting how that goes.
Not without a doubt. Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to read something for the audience here, a tweet that you shared. In 1 month, it will mark 4 years following my father's passing. Time has grown by, and I've grown immensely. Rest in peace, Dad. Here's a short thread for him. Okay, so that's on November 11th, 2015, he passed away. And you let the audience know that your dad grew up in Jordan, Jordan University, specialized in physical education and teaching, and he got you interested in soccer by waking up at 5 in the morning to watch soccer games. I mean, you write beautifully. I'm going to direct listeners to really go check that out. It's a beautiful memorial. Talk to us a little bit about how your dad inspired you.
So basically he was the motivating factor the motivating factor to get me into physical health, to get me into training, and to get me most importantly into soccer. From Jordan, which is in the Middle East, for those who don't know, soccer is almost like a religion, comparable to these South American countries and European countries. Right. So, and I visited there quite a few times for family. So that was a major catalyst in my personal growth journey, and it's been phenomenal. I wouldn't change it for the world.
That's great. I mean, it's a wonderful testament to what a parent's passion for a sport or for any activity, right, can do for a child, because it's not just about the sport. It's about spending the time bonding with you and taking you into his world, it seems.
Yes.
Like.
Yeah, and, you know, looking back on it now that I'm much older and more mature, it's interesting to pick up on all the little times where, you know, we would play soccer, whether that be on the streets in Jordan, or at school, because he was actually my physical education teacher for quite a few years. And, you know, of course, watching the soccer games at 5 in the morning, all of those things were very important.
5 a.m. Hey, early to bed, early to rise, right? That's
exactly.
It's attainable. Okay. So tell us about your history in terms of where you've lived. So I'm hearing, did you live in Jordan for a while?
Never. The longest stay I had there was 3 months. Never lived there. Most of my life I've lived in Southern California.
Home nice. Yeah. Enjoying the sun, right?
Oh, all day.
It's a wonderful area. Okay. Let's talk about where you get this, because this is a big point that I wanted to get into. where you can kind of credit and attribute your maturity, because for listeners, just a brief sampling of your tweets. You tweeted one that says, "What if you needed a break from cannabis and as opposed to more of it? In my experience, those who use it desperately need to slow down." So pot's not the answer to everything, right? So in your state, California, and in my state, Colorado, that's where I'm based out of, marijuana in many communities has taken on an almost religious sort of zeal. It's kind of a cure-all of, oh, well, it's natural, man. Just do some more pot. Doesn't have the same stigma, at least not now, especially with the opioid epidemic, right? Man-made drugs have their own really, we could say, infamous brand of stigma because of how much havoc they're causing.
Yeah.
What led you to be very insightful about that, about kind of the moderation there?
With cannabis specifically, I can say that I'm not a frequent user. Maybe I'm like 1 to 2 times a week at max, but I am still a user of it. The reason why I tend to go against, why I tend to take the opposite view in regards to it as a subject is because I see a lot of people abusing it. I see a lot of people thinking that they can get away with addictive behavior in context to it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to create echo chambers. I want to avoid echo chambers as much as possible. So then I can walk that middle path.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's really important for people to recognize that too much of anything, food, sex, television, movie, whatever it is, tends to eclipse the rest of life. It really monopolizes our time and energy, and it's not holistic at all. So speaking of the sort of balanced middle way, which I like that, using some Buddhist language, the idea of connection, phenomenal sex starts with phenomenal connection. That is another one of your tweets that's very pithy and punchy to the point. Talk a little bit about that, about what you've observed with relationships in 2019.
Of course, yeah, especially in 2019. So, like I said, you know, from my experience, obviously because I can only speak so much based off of my own experience, but I've had sex with women that from a place of disconnection, okay. And I've had sex with women from a place of connection. Trust me when I tell you, the place of connection is where you always want to be. The disconnection is, you know, obviously that ties into Tinder culture, hookup culture. And it's I'm not going to demonize it necessarily, but it's just not the healthiest path to take, especially in terms of your sexuality.
Absolutely. I love the way you talk about the culture of consumption. In a lot of your tweets, that's a theme of going with the flow, not challenging yourself, not being productive or motivated. And we'll get into your awesome mastermind groups here in a minute for that, for listeners who are interested in some accountability there. But one thing, if you know Cynthia Turlow, she is a really cool content creator here on Twitter who is a nurse practitioner, talks a lot about fasting.
Yes, we do know each other, yeah.
Yeah, she's beautiful. Her message is really accessible and awesome about like the fasting window, about processed food. And so we got into this conversation in one of our podcasts about processed communication is something I brought up. This idea of only relying, and you've tweeted about it, of relying on hookup culture and online-like culture as the way to get gratification, and how hollow that is compared to building community. So when you're talking about like Tinder culture versus actual connection, it's that conversation of a sort of counterfeit way of getting relational nutrition, right? There's just enough kernel of it that it feels like maybe you're getting filled a little bit, but ultimately you're malnourished of connection that way.
And it is scary because that's the easy thing to fall into nowadays.
Right.
The hard thing to do is to create a connection with someone over the period of 6 to 12 months and, you know, then go from there.
Yeah.
It's very scary for the kids coming up.
It does, yeah, and it takes time to build those relationships. The problem is attention span and how addictive it is to swipe or get likes, and your attention, you're being trained just like you are using that technology. The technology is using you. People need to understand it's based on addictive patterns of reinforcement. If you got a like on every time you swiped, it would be boring. If you never got a like, if you never matched, that would be boring too. But it's sort of, when will I get another? What's going to happen? Am I going to match that person that whose picture I like the most? That's the addictive quality to it. It's that intermittent way of getting reinforcement.
It's consciously created for that purpose, without
a doubt. Yeah, and I'm not going to hate on all that stuff, because I've had clients who have met the love of their life on dating sites and even Tinder, and it's become long-term. But that's when both people have the mindset of connection and are kind of using the technology, maybe almost in a subversive way that's against the norm of how it's used.
You know, funny enough that you say that, not to go on a tangent, but
I've
actually experienced that from Tinder personally. I do have one person who I've made a long-term connection with based off of that platform. It's funny how you say that.
And it can happen. And that's why I want to be careful, because there's the tendency for older generations, older than us, to talk, to naysay and be very critical thing new. And I understand that. And every new technology brings with it some fears, and then those fears kind of fall by the wayside. But television, you watch, you get information from it. It's very passive, though. It isn't something where it changes your whole attachment paradigm, right? You watch it and you disengage afterward. Maybe you think about what you learned or what movie you watched, but it doesn't change the whole narrative or and the we could say paradigm for relational connection the same way some of these technologies do now that we interact with more. The more interaction, the more chance there is for our attachment to get altered.
Oh, completely agree. Completely agree.
Yeah, it changes the metaphors there. So one thing that I wanted to talk about is your love of, maybe not love, your interest and passion for alternative medicines. I'm trying to be very PC with it, like mushrooms.
Yeah. Psychedelic compounds.
Yes. Beautiful. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, my journey with those, you know, some people call them plant teachers. I do like to fall into that category, but then, you know, there's a fine line between that and, you know, dogma and ideology, but let's just call them plant teachers for now.
Yeah.
They have taught me a lot about myself. They've taught me a lot about my weaknesses, my shortcomings. They have really, really opened up my perspective, essentially.
Right. Okay.
That has been essential, because, you know, as every other human being, you tend to get trapped within certain perspectives, certain ideas, certain frameworks, and that can limit you from doing certain things to grow. And as an example, my first heavy mushroom trip in Big Bear, which was last January, was pivotal for me in starting my Twitter journey. So then, back then I had about, what was it, like 300-400 followers. And then, you know, I really do believe that that was the catalyst that allowed me to then focus on Twitter as a platform and then grow.
Wow. Can you give us a little detail on what changes you noticed or anything you're comfortable with? Because that's a big statement. That's pretty inspiring.
It allowed me to create a vision for myself, because at the time I was already writing. So it allowed me to see myself creating a bigger impact.
Right.
And I intuitively understood that that Twitter was a platform that I needed to focus on then.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it gave me that new perspective.
There you go. Okay. something that let's launch into a conversation here that could last a while. This is going to be a really good one because it overlaps with our messages a bit here. And that's putting it mildly. The idea of meaning, the loss of it, the lack of motivation, in other words, that people are facing now. And you've created entire books about that. So I just want to give you the open floor to talk about what your passion for that and the books you're doing, the masterminds, and people out there who don't know, maybe explain a little bit about what those are. I know that's a big thing that I'm hitting with, but you've got so much on it.
Yeah. So just to talk about the masterminds real quick, I have two of them. One mainly that focuses on self-discipline, which is a problem that I see a lot of people struggling with.
Right.
The other is called the Philosopher's Inner Circle, and that covers a more broad perspective in terms of like health, relationships, wealth, and everything else.
I like it. I saw on your Instagram, which by the way, anybody listening should follow because you have a whole section about books, your library, the Philosopher's Inner Circle. you like the Alchemist book, which is kind of like got that same vibe of mystique, mystery, inner wisdom. It's a good thing. It's a good vibe.
that was a very important book for me to read, actually.
They've got a graphic novel version of it now.
Do they?
Isn't that wild? Tell us what you took away from it, if you want, the book.
I did read it a while back, but it was... If anything, it taught me the importance of trusting in, I mean, the quote-unquote universe, trusting in, like, the process.
Okay,
trusting in the journey. And, you know, if you set your mind to something, good things will happen, assuming that you work hard, of course.
Right. Power of intention, the power of setting goals and pursuing them, but not being so absolutely focused on everything going right that you don't trust the universe. Good points. So let's talk about what do you think about the lack of motivation and meaning that people are facing now? And where do you think that stems from if you had to give it a few different causes? We can kind of hammer that out.
Mm. Yeah, the lack of motivation and meaning. I think a big thing, a big cause to that type of dysfunction is lifestyle. So that's when we get into the whole holistic aspect, you know, the way people sleep, the way people eat, the way people move, the way they breathe, all of that, you know, for most people, when they immediately hear that, they don't make the connection between those two.
Right.
But from my experience, those two, I mean, it's the foundation, because without those things, without the energy to pursue meaning and to implement discipline, then you just fall into the trap of, you know, a dysfunctional cycle. And that's not the place you want to be.
Right. Absolutely. There's a kind of mechanization of our routine now. Have you seen the movie WALL-E, the one with the little robot?
Yes.
The Pixar movie. Okay. So what's most striking to me about it, of course, the beautiful visuals, but as a therapist and person who's studied psychology academically and just off the cuff too, the absolute accuracy of what a culture would look like with no sort of drive or motivation or goals at all. The people who are obese in the chairs, who have all of their decisions limited to pressing a button. I mean, and you look at how stagnating that is, and we're towards that now. I'd say we're kind of 30% maybe. Maybe I'm being a little too negative, but about 30% toward how much stuff can be automated compared to that. I mean, it takes away the adventure and the drive, the motivation that previous generations had. People could say, well, but what if you can automate it? Isn't that worthless? Well, not really. Going down to a store, you may have an idea that you wouldn't getting something on Amazon. Now, I'm guilty of using Amazon. I love, there's stuff you get on there that you wouldn't be able to at a local general store. So again, it's kind of balancing the importance of that stuff, but not letting it monopolize you. But when people feel this decision fatigue, another concept of having so many decisions, they often won't make any.
Yes.
So that's another thing, is it's like we have things handed to us easily, but also people don't know what to do in life. They don't, like, if your father was a lawyer or a doctor and you were just going to do that, maybe you put your own spin on it and it's still a quest and a journey, but you know where you're going. It's like for you, you learned to love soccer, but you're your own man with it, right? You have a path. You had a father that taught you how to look at things and be ambitious and what to be passionate about. But when people think they can do everything, then they don't really do anything.
A good book for anyone who wants to read more about that topic is The Paradox of Choice. I think it's Barry Schwartz is that, I'm not sure who the author is, but The Paradox of Choice.
Yes, Barry Schwartz. He did The Tools, which is another great book.
I haven't read that one, but I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's just about ways to motivate yourself, and it's written from kind of a psychotherapist perspective. So that's wonderful. Let's talk about, I looked at your library on Instagram and saw Atomic Habits. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? If you can think of some stuff from that book.
I'm game for that. I haven't read all of it, but I've taken some of the concepts in. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I haven't read all of it either. I just know that it's very focused on intentional small habit setting. So for people out there who...
You know, actually the biggest takeaway from that book that I've gotten is the concept of starting small. And it's something that I've struggled with for a lot of my life, especially as an obsessive character.
Yes.
I tend to take on the world when I first start, but it's so liberating to just start small. You know, instead of wanting to meditate for 60 minutes per day, just start for 5 minutes per day.
Right.
It's the counterintuitive thing to do. And, you know, when you follow through with that, you begin to realize how much pressure and stress is released from your shoulders and overall experience.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. People can become daunted by their ultimate goals. Like if their goal is to be more mindful and they want to do that in a way that is like the classical Buddhist master way, they want to get there immediately, then the paradox is that they're not going to typically. It can be very discouraging if you can't be as mindful as you want right away. So the very practice of it is to relinquish those expectations and to start small, right? So mindful goals. Another thing that you really talk about that I love a lot is mindfulness. And you've got two books by Thich Nhat Hanh, the acclaimed, we'll say, monk. Talk a little bit about what you've learned from him and what you love from his works.
What I love from him the most is the simplicity in which he explains it. It's not a when people hear mindfulness, they think of this complex thing that, you know, out in the sky.
Yes.
Or something of that nature. But the way he puts it, the way he explains it, it's to the point, and it just hits you like a lightning bolt. It makes sense. It makes intuitive sense. So that's the biggest thing I've taken away from him and the way he writes.
Yes. So I was, when I started out as a counselor, I was teaching an anger management group to people, and I used his book, Cooling the Flames of Anger, Wisdom for Cooling the Flames, excuse me. That's what it was called. He talks about treating anger like a needy child. It's like his metaphor is spectacular.
Yeah.
And that's something I can tell you like, because some of your tweets use brilliant metaphor, like using dirt as gossip, but saying you need dirt to plant things and to grow. So you're kind of saying your story may have some elements to it that are less than favorable, but that's what's going to grow change.
Exactly. Exactly. Anything that's concise to the point and just makes sense, makes you think.
Yeah.
That's in my wheelhouse for sure.
There you go. Okay. So for everybody out there, I'm really going to encourage picking up some books by Thich Nhat Hanh. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I mean, that's always how I've heard it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's discuss so something that I'm really going to direct people toward is the article, The Americanization of Mental Illness by Ethan Waters. So that if you've looked at other New York Times articles, it may set come up an error message saying, oh, you can't do that because you've looked at however many this month. I don't know what's up with that. But if you can't see that article, because it's from the New York Times, he also authored this book, Crazy Like Us, that's all about the exportation of American Western mental health and values and how it's affecting the world adversely. So let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on that. I want to quote you here. You said, you must reject the conventional mindset. It rejects vitality. It rejects abundance. It rejects enthusiasm. What it accepts are the ingredients that produce a physical, mental, and spiritual cancer. Wow, extremely powerful. What do you think, what does that article say to you, or how did you come up across it?
What I most thought of is, obviously there are circumstances where mental illness is real. I'm not one of those people who denies all mental illnesses, of course. But there is a phenomenon going on where people, because of the way that people live, because they don't have purpose, because they don't do the right things to become a healthy human being, then naturally anxiety and depression manifests. And, you know, anxiety and depression is normal to a certain extent. But when you begin to identify with it and when it begins to become your normal experience in life, then I think things need to change in a drastic manner. And I do think that a lot of people give power to the labels of anxiety and depression when in fact they can, you know, just make a few adjustments and they can find themselves out of that funk.
I think that's an absolutely valid point. When you look at psychotic illnesses and those that have organic components and precursors, things that may be more genetic in nature, we can say, all right, even the way those are manifested in that article, they can be influenced by family response, right? So even the most, all the way from the most subjective illnesses that don't have as much of a genetic component to those that do, culture impacts in some discernible way.
And also, let's not forget that there's a cultural momentum or there's an agenda going on. Now, I'm not going to say it's, you know, I'm not going to get into conspiracy theories or anything, but at the end of the day, pharmaceutical companies, for example, want to push more of their drugs so that they can make more money. And, you know, if they can manipulate media in such a way that it works out towards their favor, then they will do that. And I think history has shown that there's been a lot of, you know, manipulation and buffoonery that's been going on in order to make money and push a certain agenda.
It's definitely a good point, because if you look at the way we've been indoctrinated, it's like you need food to have energy. Okay, a one-to-one correlation there, you know, for survival. If you're depressed, you need an antidepressant. And it's not that simple. It's not the same one-to-one correlation of gap in something and a need. There's a book that I would recommend to anyone. It's called Cracked, The Unhappy Truth of Psychiatry. And it's about our ideas on the neurochemical imbalance hypothesis. Okay, so that entire hypothesis is pretty tenuous. It's not fully understood, just like we could say hypothetical and speculative how a lot of antidepressants work. There was this sort of trial and error approach in psychiatry. And the fact that depression is something that you have 2 weeks and over, you're depressed. If it's a week and 6 days, well, you haven't reached the threshold yet. Why? Is that organic? No, that was decided upon by the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah. And you know, I've gone through 2 to 3 month periods where I just cannot seem to get out of this dark space. And you know, that mainly came down to life events,
right?
But a part of me understood that, you know, this too shall pass. as right. with anything else.
Yeah. So, and I think I want to be careful here, me in particular, because I'm not saying that drugs are never necessary. And in fact, I really recommend, I know that research shows prognosis is great with clients with depression, anxiety, they're taking medication and getting psychotherapy. You got that 1-2 punch there, but it certainly doesn't just need to be a passive way of taking medication and looking at it as, okay, I'm taking this pill. Now, why is it not working immediately when I've changed nothing? That's what I never think is a good idea. Medication can always be helpful, but no change in lifestyle, that's a recipe to continue feeling poorly.
Agreed.
Yeah. You and Paul Dominic have kind of similar messages. There's definitely differences there. You guys are unique and awesome, but this idea of go out and do something, change your life to get a different emotional state. And I think more young people are actually getting that now because they're disillusioned with this idea of being a passive consumer. That goes along with your message in general of don't passively consume anything.
And you know, not even change your life to change your emotional state. Change the next action that you are about to take. Go for a run. Go, you know, take a sauna session. Go float in a sensory deprivation tank. Do any of these things and you will notice a change in your emotional state.
All right. Now you're talking. Saunas are amazing, by the way. Infrared ones are pretty spectacular as well. Changing your body state is a big part of a lot of therapeutic modalities of, you know, our emotions come in many ways from our physiological sensations. A lot of the time we have a physiological sensation and our brain interprets that. Do something different with it. Teach yourself that that emotion doesn't dictate what you're going to do next necessarily. Mm-hmm. You don't have to follow depression. You can do something different with it. Go against the desire to isolate because that compounds the cycle of depression.
And a lot of trauma is stored in the body as well. So that's an important thing.
Oh, listen, Zay, that is a conversation we could have for a long time. I work with a lot of trauma survivors, and there's a book I recommend for anyone who's not triggered easily because there's some stories in there, but it for a lot of people, it would be fine to read. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. It's by a psychiatrist who, let's just say, is disillusioned with the typical medical model. He's not your typical psychiatrist. He's very educated. His name's Bessel van der Kolk. He's amazing and inspirational to many people because he talks about not only drug therapy, but MDMA for veterans to relive and to go through the trauma and be done with it on the other side. So that overlaps with some of the psychedelic therapy stuff. The idea of yoga, Tai Chi, somatic experiencing therapies to release the stored traumatic memories.
You know, it's a new perspective. It's all about perspectives and new ways of doing things. So if it helps people solve their problems, I'm all for it.
Isn't it spectacular how what's old is new again? Because yoga and Tai Chi and body therapies that are now used and very on the cutting edge, so to speak, are so ancient. Our wisdom of the body, if we just go back and look at it, is very time honored. It's recently that we've really developed a hatred for the body in this cerebralization. Well, not necessarily, because Gnostics had that too. It's kind of a classic battle of integration versus separation.
Who would have thought that monks who would renounce the Western lifestyle and spend 40 years meditating, you know, on top of a mountain, had things figured out? You know, it's funny how it works. Not to say that they have everything figured out, but
right,
I mean, to make that kind of commitment, there's clearly something there.
Absolutely, I agree with you completely. So, here in Colorado, by the way, psilocybin mushrooms have been decriminalized. That was a recent thing that went through last year. So,
beautiful news.
It'll be interesting to see what happens because, it is. It can be beautiful for sure. There's an article that is titled "Clinical Potential of Psilocybin as a Treatment for Mental Health Conditions," and I will link that along with other stuff that we're talking about in the description of the podcast. But the article compiles a lot of studies and case studies too of people with things like OCD, treatment-resistant OCD, right? And other illnesses, anxiety, of course, and how responsive the limited mushroom therapy is. And that's what it's got to be within reason, right? Because you're using it to get back into life, not to escape from it. That's another big point.
Yes, yes, big time, big time.
Who are some of your role models or people that you positively view on Twitter or online, if you wouldn't mind me asking that?
Role models, you know, I view a lot of people positively online. I do view them in a positive light. To mention a few, mainly the big names, as you mentioned earlier, Alexander Cortez.
Right.
Big motivating factor for me to, you know, also get started on Twitter and grow my following. Ed Lattimore, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Yes, I am. He and Ajak team up quite a bit. He and AJ for things. Yeah. They had a podcast for a little bit. Yeah.
Who else can I think about? And just, you know, just a few people who have helped spread my message, really.
Absolutely.
And to all the followers, really. I mean, they've just helped spread my message. They've helped give me a new perspective, and that's very nice to see.
It absolutely is. Something unique about your account that I really appreciate is your library. And I know I've mentioned it a few times here, but directing people toward sources that they might find really helpful. To realize that other people have struggled with whatever it is you're discussing and that there are ways forward. And the community aspect of your mastermind groups, that's crucial because people can read all the content in the world. Mm-hmm. But if there's no dedication or diligence, it's not going to come. Nothing's going to come of it.
It's all for nothing. At the end of the day, if you're not taking action, it really is all for nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point. What do you think? Have you read any of Jocko Willink's stuff? The guy who he's really big on discipline, by the way.
I haven't read any of his books, but I am a big fan of his podcast. Big fan.
Ah, yes. Okay. I need to listen to that more. I know he's been on Joe Rogan as well.
Yes. And his podcasts are the same length as Joe Rogan. So 2-3 hours. Expect it.
Just getting down on it and exploring every facet of the guest. That's funny.
Yeah.
So David Goggins is another one of those characters too, who's very into sort of fragility, being anti-fragile.
Yes.
What do you think are, and again, this is a big question, and I don't expect us to hammer out every answer right here. Not that lofty here. But I would like to get some ideas from you on what you think is causing, and what you're seeing with men, like the lack of motivation, drive, and meaning. With them in particular, noticed that.
I have noticed that, especially within peer groups and society at large.
Right.
Good thing you bring up David Goggins and Jocko. David Goggins, you know, he has the concept of going into the cookie jar. Okay, and that's a big one. I don't think. Are you familiar with the cookie jar?
Yeah, but let's tell it a little bit just for listeners here.
I'm not sure if it's you create positive things or you put you bring up or you manifest positive things within your mind or negative things. Is it negative?
You know what? I am not sure.
I think it is negative, but basically he talks a lot about utilizing your insecurities, your fears, your doubts, and putting that, placing that kind of energy into your work and just getting better. And to connect that with modern men today, I think a lot of men don't do the hard things. A lot of young boys would much rather play video games and, you know, choose the easy path. A lot of men would much rather sit around and watch Sunday night football. That's the sad reality that a lot of men are facing today. But then there's also good news for those men who do place themselves in tough circumstances because, you know, the bar is really set pretty low.
So yes.
It doesn't take that much to rise above the crowd.
Right. Well, if we go back to hunter-gatherer roots, if there's nothing to hunt or gather, we're kind of immobilized. So men are especially hit by like a lack of mission if they don't feel that there's anything to strive for.
Yeah.
And unless they're relationally intelligent, they're not going to seek out people who will challenge them typically. I mean, when our drive is to maximize pleasure and reduce pain, that evolutionarily worked even decades ago, not just thousands or hundreds of years ago. But when we entertain ourselves to death now, and development is caused by stretching outside your comfort zone consistently. And you talk a lot about that in your tweets, about development being painful, it being necessary to get outside your comfort zone for that. So I found the cookie jar. It is the place where you put all your great achievements and all your epic failures. So it's both. So Goggins says, some people try to forget the bad in their life. I use my bad for strength when needed. Great lessons learned. In that cookie jar, I pull out whatever I need for the task at hand. So it's a reconceptualization, really. It's what we would call reframing of negative into like the tapestry of your life into, well, this made me who I am and I need this now. I learned this lesson. It's really being mindful in how you address things, it would seem.
Yeah. And also, if any of the listeners want to experience what the cookie jar is, want to experience that feeling, go for a run that is just beyond, let's say you run 5 miles regularly. Go for a 10-mile run. Okay. Push yourself to the point where you're like, you know, I don't know if I can do this. I'm really struggling here. And that's exactly when you go into your own mind. And that's where you pull up things from the cookie jar, whether it be the death of your father, whether it be, you know, that girl who called you a certain name and put you down in front of everyone. You know, the list goes.
Right. Beautiful. The body and mind really are inextricably linked. They running and doing other things that cause us to think clearly and activate our brains. There's a real processing element to that. All right. One of the big things that you share also, in addition to discipline, is just how important it is to be realistic. I like that it doesn't get overwhelming when you share your message, because you tell people perfectionism is a disease. I like that metaphor that you use. It really is, and it has to be treated as one. Begin by creating things, learn from your mistakes, and adjust your approach. I like that. That really is like the cookie jar technique, by the way. You're talking about remembering our mistakes and learning from those. That's a thing that people tend to maybe miss now, is making the same mistakes. And it's been normalized in a way that may be a little too familiar, a little too, relatable and encouraging almost of, oh, we'll go out and make mistakes. And the tweets that are a joke about like choosing the same men and how it's just going to happen. When we look at, and that's like exporting American westernized mental illness, right? It's like looking at it as, well, this is just a part of, this is a rite of passage. If you view something as a rite of passage, it will become one.
Yeah.
It's very self-confirming. So that's something I think about, is your big message is go into things, one small step a day new toward something, toward your development, and don't get obsessed with doing it right. Just do it and don't be perfectionistic. Be okay with making mistakes.
Yeah. And I totally understand where people are coming from. You know, they look at what they want to achieve, the big picture, and they fail to recognize all of the smaller steps that lead up to that. And it's just, you are shooting yourself in the foot before you're about to, you know, start the race. It's like, it's a losing battle.
Absolutely. 100%. And there's never been a time where introspection and the sort of navel gazing, looking inward in a damaging way, has been more prevalent. I mean, we're taught that that's the solution. Well, mindfulness is about being non-judgmental and present-minded. It doesn't involve negatively evaluating things the same way that we're often encouraged to now, and being almost obsessively. It's a negative form of narcissism.
Yes. Yeah. Agreed.
Very cool stuff here. So you've got a lot of eBooks that are available. If people just go to your Twitter page and your account, and then click on your Gumroad account, things about anxiety.
My latest book that's coming out, which I'm working on right now, it's on pre-sale, is The Universal Principles to Creating the Good Life. I hear a lot about Stoic philosophy and what the good life is. So this book is my attempt to bring literally almost every rule of thumb, every heuristic, every wise idea together, so that people can then, you know, treat it like a buffet, kind of like the Tim Ferriss style books.
Yes.
And then, you know, go on and practically use that.
That's so fascinating that you would bring that up, because his book, I love books where they're like nodes that connect you to other sources of knowledge, like those buffet style books you're talking about. Tim Ferriss's Tools of Titans book, I've drawn on that for use with clients before. The idea of thinking of how big the universe is compared to whatever problem we have. So many things, like the journaling exercises that were recommended by, let's see, who am I thinking of? Tony Robbins. Things of that nature are just so helpful for people. And the only thing is, the books are huge, so people may want to get like a get it on their Kindle. But then again, you can't really annotate or highlight. I mean, you can, but it's different with a real book.
Yeah, no, I had to get the physical copies. Yeah. There's something about the physical copies.
Yeah, I completely feel that. That's how it is for me too. All right, well, if you want to hit the audience with wherever, you kind of did. Your upcoming project's amazing. I think people are going to be really helped by that. It's going to be awesome for people. If you have any other messages or anything you want to share, maybe about, we kind of glossed over about trauma. If you have any thoughts on that, because that's kind of my wheelhouse. I'm really passionate about it.
From my perspective, trauma really, the starting point to change in a positive direction is always going to be self-awareness. So the more you can develop self-awareness, and, you know, self-awareness is not complicated. It's literally just observing or understanding in the present moment what you're struggling with or what you're going through. The more you can develop that, the more likely you are to take other steps in order to solve whatever trauma you may be going through right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just to hammer home the importance of meaning, of doing things that you find relevant, finding a quest. One of your tweets encourages people to find what they're naturally good at. So go out and explore things, and don't be afraid to do that and find what calls to you. But again, that's a thing I think people are not taught to do. They're kind of thought of as blank slates, but people can have natural talents and predilections toward things. That's an understatement.
And, you know, I was very fortunate to stumble upon soccer when I was first, you know, 4 years old, so very early on. But there was a lot of work, there was a lot of repetition there that was involved, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But at the end of the day, you know, the common theme from my experience with soccer for this 18 to 19 year period so far is it's something that I'm just built to do. It's just something that works well with me. It meshes in with my physique, my body type, my psychology. it's something that I just latched onto from an early age.
And then you, when you have a tendency to be good at it for your age, and then you do it more and you see that you're getting better, you become even better at it as you're encouraged. It's a real positive feedback loop there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it teaches you much more. It teaches you a lot about life as well. Not just sport itself.
Soccer in California with some philosophy on the side, right? Discipline. It's a good message.
There's nothing better than that for me. Nothing better.
That's awesome, dude. All right. Well, as we wrap up, if there's anything you can think of that you want to put out there for listeners, anywhere to find you or any stuff that you encourage them to do, go ahead and feel free.
Everything you'll find mainly through Twitter. You know, I'm currently working on revamping my website because I've neglected that for some time. But my website is first and last name, www.firstandlastname.com, which is zaidahodge.com.
Yep.
Other than that, Twitter is the main place.
All right, man. Thank you so much for coming on. And I think listeners are really going to benefit from this deep dive into your philosophy.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. You've been wonderful. Thank you.
Oop. Stop recording.